This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The phrase of the day today is price elasticity of demand in consumer goods, in real estate, also in a sense, in global trade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 31st day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Look, I get it. We do a lot of trade on this program. I get it. I really do. Maybe too much, depending on who you ask. But you know what? Well, first of all, trade matters. Think for a second about how much we buy and sell from and to overseas in this economy. But also, trade is news. Yes, tariffs and the trade war, but it's news even without the United States. Exhibit A today, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Say what, you say? Well, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, the big trade deal with 11 other countries that President Trump pulled this country out of just about as soon as he got into office. Thing is, the TPP lives on. As of this morning, six of those 11 countries have ratified the thing, and it's going to take effect just before New Year's without the United States. And as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, how you feel about that depends on how you feel about the deal.
The U.S. is missing out on $133 billion a year by not being in the TPP. So says Peter Petrie at Brandeis University.
That's a combination of foregoing the gains that it could have had by being in it and some losses as a result of trade being diverted from the United States.
$133 billion is a pea, a pebble, a drip when you consider how ginormous the U.S. economy is. But Petrie says that number could be significant if and when other big countries join the pact. The TPP cuts tariffs, yes, but also unifies regulations among its members, which can give U.S. competitors and TPP countries a hefty advantage, says Susan Aronson. She's a professor at George Washington University.
Business people and workers and consumers all need shared rules, whether they're on privacy or they're on safety belts or drug regulation.
But none of these are good enough reasons to have stayed in the deal, says Lori Wallach, head of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch.
I think a lot of people here and a lot of members of Congress feel like we avoided the damage of the TPP here, but at the same time, given what is in the agreement, feel very badly that people in those other countries are going to suffer the consequences.
Wallach says the deal gave too much power to corporations, labor, the environment, too little. She's watching this deal move forward and is glad the U.S. isn't on board. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
We're going to do a story on prices now and how they are going up. Because for most of the past 10 years in this economy, consumer goods companies didn't really have what's known as pricing power. Consumers just weren't having it. Now, though, with rising interest rates and just a hint of inflation, well, here we go. Procter & Gamble is raising prices on Pampers by around 4%, on Bounty, Charmin, and Puffs by about 5%. Unilever and Nestle are doing the same, not quite as big a percentage increases. So Marketplace's Mariel Segarra asked consumers whether they've been noticing these rising prices and how much of a price hike might be too much.
Olivia Sproul recently got an early lesson in budgeting. She's 2 years old. Her parents buy her diapers online. And this summer, her mom, Kelsey, noticed that the monthly cost had jumped from 70 to 85 bucks.
I just thought these things are way too expensive.
So Kelsey, who's 33 and lives in Iowa City, sat Olivia down and broke the news. It's time to start potty training.
We're going to get rid of the diapers and you're going to feel better and we're going to feel better. Everybody will be proud of you.
Everybody has a limit to what they're willing to pay for a particular product. We heard from a lot of you today. You won't pay more than $4 for a 12-pack of soda or $5 for a bar of chocolate. But some consumers can't walk away from higher prices. Kelly Koletsky is 56. He lives in Columbus, Ohio, and he has sensitive teeth. And he's noticed the price of toothpaste for his condition has crept up by almost a dollar in the past few months.
If I didn't need it, I would buy the cheapest possible tube of toothpaste anywhere.
We realize these are all anecdotes. In other words, things that you noticed. Gus Fauché is chief economist at PNC.
It could be that you notice the prices of items that go up, but you don't notice the prices of items that either stay steady or go down.
Procter & Gamble is still rolling out its price hikes. Nestle is considering another round. And it can take months for those to show up in federal inflation numbers. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
There's a pretty good set of things in my Twitter mentions about things people would or would not give up. Check it out. I'm at Kai Rizdahl on Twitter. Price hikes, by the way, were the order of the day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, according to the Census Bureau via the Pew Research Center, more than 29 million Latinos eligible to vote this coming Tuesday. That's almost 13% of the entire electorate. Political spending and campaign decision-making are some peculiar mix of demographics and instinct and black magic, yes. So there hasn't been a whole lot of investment in ads targeting Latino voters. But as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports from KUT in Austin, what voters do hear in Spanish-language ads can be quite different from what they hear in English.
In Texas, you can see ads for Republican U.S. Senate candidate Ted Cruz in English.
I'm Ted Cruz, and I approve this message.
Texas is booming.
And in Spanish, like this ad featuring the senator's dad, who came to the U.S. from Cuba in the late 1950s.
La promesa de libertad me ayudó a resistir la tortura.
Juan Cicada has seen both ads. The 33-year-old Austinite is a computer scientist and bilingual. He says the Spanish ad seems to take a different tack, with the elder Cruz talking about the opportunities America gave him as a refugee and the American dream.
Yeah, you can definitely see the complete difference, right? So there is no talk about here's this policy, here is this position that's being taken. It is completely emotional.
Tugging at the heartstrings has been the playbook for most political ads in Spanish, says Marissa Abrajano. She teaches political science at the University of California, San Diego.
A lot of the Spanish language ads were really focused on culture, on these emotional messages, talking about the American dream and Latinos caring about family values, shared values.
She worries that Spanish-only voters will be left in the dark if these ads only play on emotion and talk less about economic growth, taxes, or health care.
If you specifically design Spanish language ads that omit much more policy content than English language ads, then Spanish-speaking voters are not getting the same kind of information that monolingual English language folks get.
Almost a third of all eligible voters in Texas and California are Hispanic, and their numbers are growing in many states across the country. Many of those households speak predominantly Spanish. The Democratic Party did spend some cash this week to galvanize the Spanish-speaking vote, but overall, is spending on Spanish-language ads going through the roof?
The answer to that question is not really.
That's Armando Azarloza. He runs an L.A. marketing firm and used to help craft TV ads in Spanish for Republican candidates. He says we won't have a clear picture of exactly how much has been spent on Spanish ads until after the midterms. We do know that spending during the 2016 presidential campaign was less than $3 million, down from $20 million 10 years before. Azarloza thinks eventually there's going to be a tipping point.
We're a larger part of the electorate every single year, but we're still, political parties still underinvest in that outreach.
In Texas, Beto O'Rourke, Ted Cruz's Democratic challenger, also has ads in English and Spanish. He's fluent in Spanish, so recording one more ad just requires another take, not really a heavy investment. The real cost of both campaigns goes into figuring out where to place those ads. Yale University political science professor Alex Kopic recently published a study on the effectiveness of ads in Spanish.
The major cost, and this is why I think we don't see more candidates doing it, is if you hit a monolingual English-only person with the Spanish version, they react extremely negatively.
He says it could be that English-only speakers tend to bristle at ads in Spanish because they want the candidates to appeal to their own culture. Kopic says the main problem campaigns have is that the data on who speaks Spanish in a community isn't specific enough.
You know, this might be the sort of thing that works better when you can target at the individual level, like online advertisements.
Your online behavior, what you search for and what you read, tells a politician more about what language you prefer than your zip code does, which means the future of Spanish political ads could be more targeted to your Facebook feed than what's on your TV. In Austin, Texas, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Of all the times to start a new job running one of the biggest financial companies in this economy, one would imagine that October 2008 would be just about the worst. But sometimes you got to play the hand you're dealt, right? So Walt Bettinger did, taking over as CEO and president of Charles Schwab from Charles Schwab himself 10 years ago this month. And to hear him tell it, which we will, he's actually had a pretty good decade. Walt Bettinger, welcome to the program, sir.
Thanks a lot, Kai. It's great to have the opportunity to spend time together.
As I noted in the introduction, you've been at this company 10 years, which means you took over 10 years ago in the middle of the worst financial crisis this country's seen in a generation or more. What were those days like for a financial services company guy?
You know, at that point in time, there was very little that you could do. The outcome that your company would experience as a result of that crisis was more the result of the decisions you made prior to when you were deep in the middle of that crisis.
So were you going into work every day just kind of hanging on for the ride?
No, it wasn't quite like that. I think in my first 90 days as CEO, I was successful in having the stock price. There probably aren't many CEOs that have made it a decade who are able to achieve that.
Yeah. What is it, or was it, I suppose, about financial services that got you going? I mean, you founded your first financial services, your own financial services company when you were like 20, what, 2 or 3 or something?
22. Actually, my formal training was as a pension actuary, so I provided consulting services. Eventually, that business evolved to where we needed a link between our computer systems and where the money resided. And we linked up with Schwab, and over a few years, we became Schwab's largest client, and then Schwab acquired my firm a few years after that.
You know, your boss, Charles Schwab, who is still the chairman of the board and active in the company, as I understand it. Also, by the way, like the second or third CEO I did in this series, lo, these many years ago. But anyway, he and you all originated the concept really at scale of discount retail brokerage. And I wonder if you look around now and see that everybody's catching up to you because fees are going down and all of those things are happening that have to affect your business.
Well, I don't think there's any organization that's generating the net new asset flows that we are, the new household flows that we are, the new accounts. So I don't know that I would go so far as to say people are catching up to us, but more people understanding that it is important to not only deliver quality service and quality advice to investors, but also do so at a value that leaves more money in their pocket. That's a good thing. You know, we're a large institution, $3.5 trillion. We're focused on building an organization and rewarding our stockholders, communities, employees. But ultimately, it all originates with whether we're doing the right thing by our clients. And I'm a whole lot more proud of the fact that we also generate less revenue per dollar on every client asset than anyone else of size.
Wow. Does your board know you feel that way? You're generating less revenue? Come on.
Absolutely. Less revenue per dollar, because what it ultimately means, Kai, is we're leaving more money in the pocket of the investor, and it was their money to begin with. I mean, our job is about helping them get outcomes that make sense. And to the extent we do that, they'll reward us with more business. I think that's a whole lot better way to grow than to try to extract maximum revenue from every client. And ultimately, I would say that Chuck would view that as maybe one of the most important legacies of his founding this company over 4 decades ago.
How often do you talk to him? Every day?
I just left his office about 5 minutes before I put the headset on.
All right. Fair enough. So if business is good, what do you worry about as a guy who, as you said, manages $3 and something trillion worth of other people's money?
Well, certainly the cyber environment is a significant risk for all of us. You're talking about thousands of attempts every single day to try to access clients' accounts or access systems. And of course, the financial environment in our country and really around the world is predicated to a great extent on trust. And therefore, any organization like ours has to think about cyber at the top of the list.
Walt Bettinger, President and CEO of Charles Schwab. Walt, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Kai, thanks for your time today.
Two things about that interview. First of all, and full disclosure, careful listeners will know, and everybody should be aware that Charles Schwab is an underwriter of this program. Also, you can hear what Walt Bettinger had to say about a lighter touch on banking regulations. Here's a spoiler alert. He's good with banking regulations the way they are now. You can hear it on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
The 30-year term did not come down on a tablet engraved, you know, that says 30 years is the right number.
Why then all those 30-year mortgages, First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 241 today, 0.9% closed at 25,115. I would not have gone with the really happy music myself, but whatevs. NASDAQ found itself 144 points to the good, 2%, 7305. I know, poor Shawnee can't win. S&P 500 rose 29 points, 1%, ended at 27.11. For the month, the Dow off 6.3% today, the NASDAQ off 8.9%, the S&P 500 declined 7.3%. GM beat profit and revenue forecasts in its latest quarter. GM up 9% today. Facebook fell a little short on revenue and monthly active users, but it beat expectations for earnings per share. Facebook advanced 3.8% today. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.15%. You're listening to Marketplace. Sign up for our daily e-newsletter by October 31st, and you could be in for a Halloween treat. We're giving away 10 Marketplace treat bags filled with some great swag, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what goes into bringing you the program every single day. A rundown that I will sign personally. Subscribe today at Marketplace.org for your chance to win, and good luck. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're going to spend the second half of the program today on real estate, how we pay for homes, first of all, and then how there aren't enough affordable places to live, specifically here in California. The average interest rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage was up just a hair this week to 4.86%. That's according to Freddie Mac. And it is, as it happens, almost a full percentage point higher than the 30-year fixed was a year ago. Those higher rates are, of course, changing the home buying equation, as would-be buyers weigh the rising costs of borrowing. And what's happening in response, in some markets, we should say, not all of them, but in some of them, is that prices are starting to dip just a little bit, and sales are too. One thing, though, in that equation remains constant. The vast majority of new mortgages in this country are of the 30-year fixed variety. Why? Marketplace's Amy Scott has the origin story.
Ask people about their mortgage like we did in D.C. this week, and you'll hear a lot of this.
It's a 30-year mortgage.
I paid off my mortgage. It was a 30-year.
I had three mortgages, actually. They are 30-year mortgages.
Why 30 years?
Because that's the industry standard?
Nope. I have no idea.
The 30-year term did not come down on a tablet engraved, you know, that says 30 years is the right number.
Well, so much for the biblical explanation. That voice of reason was Edward Pinto with the American Enterprise Institute. He says the 30-year mortgage actually came about because of a housing crisis. Yeah, not that housing crisis. One in the last century. Back in the 1920s, a typical mortgage was for 3 to 5 years with a variable interest rate, and payments only covered the interest.
Which means that at the end of that time, you owed all the money. And so this big balloon payment came due at the end.
Historian Lewis Hyman at Cornell University says at that point, most people just borrowed the money again for another 3 to 5 years. That worked, Hyman says, as long as banks had money to lend. But
when the Great Depression hit, people began to pull their money. And there was a financing crisis in 1932 for mortgages.
Hundreds of thousands of people suddenly faced foreclosure. Enter the country's new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
We come to the relief for a moment of those who are in danger of losing their farms or their homes.
In 1933, he launched the New Deal and set off a wholesale rethinking of the way we buy homes. Congress created the Homeowners Loan Corporation to buy failing mortgages and convert them into longer-term loans with payments that included interest and principal. Then came the Federal Housing Administration, which insured mortgages against default and set new standards for those loans. Hello, 15-year mortgage. Andra Gent teaches real estate finance at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
And then basically the FHA kind of keeps pushing it to 20 years and then 25 and then 30.
For buyers, predictable payments over a long period of time made homeownership more affordable. But for banks, a 30-year mortgage with a fixed interest rate didn't make a lot of sense. The interest they had to pay to depositors and to borrow money wasn't fixed. So in the 1970s, Congress took care of that problem. It authorized Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to buy mortgages from lenders, taking the risk off their books.
So again, we have some government intervention that, oh, okay, I have no problem making a 30-year loan because I know Fannie and Freddie are going to buy it.
And that, in a nutshell, is how the 30-year mortgage became king. But maybe it shouldn't be. Don't forget.
The 30-year term did not come down on a tablet engraved, you know, that says 30 years is the right number.
AEI's Edward Pinto says, for starters, the 30-year mortgage pushes up home prices by making it easier for buyers to manage a bigger loan. They end up paying a lot more interest over the life of the loan. And
the amount of principal relative to interest is very small, and it takes a very long time to build up equity.
Okay, but at this point, the 30-year is so ingrained in the home buying system that last month, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, 88% of applications were for, yeah, that one. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There are going to be 11 statewide propositions on the California ballot next Tuesday. How number 10 turns out is going to be closely watched by landlords and tenants alike. It's about rent control. It would expand the power that local governments, mostly cities, have to make more apartments and rental houses subject to limits on rent increases. It's a hot button issue here in a state where housing prices are really, really high. But the fight over Prop 10 does kind of reflect the shortage of affordable housing across the country. From KPCC in Los Angeles, Matt Tinoco has more.
On a recent day in LA's Exposition Park neighborhood, Steve Baldwin, who's in his 40s, is helping his friend JJ move out of the room he's rented for the past 7 years in a group home.
I wanted to get this stuff, just this little stuff right here to store it. This to store it.
He paid $700 a month. JJ has to leave because his landlord is rehabbing the building to rent to students who go to the nearby University of Southern California. Probably for more money. The landlord wouldn't say.
So now that everything's getting built up, looking fancy, smashy, okay, you guys can go now.
Baldwin used to have the same landlord, but he and roughly 80 other tenants, including his two sons, were evicted from six other buildings on the same block, also being rehabbed for student rentals.
So it's hard, man, it's hard.
He's currently sleeping in his car, and his sons are staying with family while he tries to track down a new place to live. A tall order in LA's infamously expensive rental market.
It's pushing me further and further out from LA to the Inland Empire to just to find something.
Baldwin and his fellow tenants couldn't appeal their evictions because their buildings aren't covered under LA's rent stabilization ordinance. It caps rent increases to 3% a year and also limits evictions to lease violations only. But those rules only apply to units built before 1978. Baldwin's and the other buildings were newer.
You have no rights. You just gotta go.
A state law called Costa-Hawkins prevents LA from expanding its rent control. It also limits other cities from applying rent control rules to condos, single-family homes, and apartments built since 1995. Proposition 10 would repeal Costa-Hawkins and let cities regulate their rental markets as they choose. Baldwin's on board.
We got to vote. Yes, on 10.
It's one of the hottest issues in California this election cycle, a state where housing costs have spiraled up, as has homelessness. More than $90 million has been spent to sway voters, nearly three quarters of that by landlords. Tenants' rights groups say Prop 10 would tamp down rising rents and slow displacement for low-income people. But opponents, like San Diego property management consultant Robert McGuire, say it could make California's housing crisis even worse.
The big thing is we've got to build our way out of this.
State officials say housing costs are so high because California is short about 2 million homes. McGuire says rent regulations would dissuade developers from building new units if their return on investment could be limited. Rent control rules are rare in the U.S. Just 15 California cities have them, along with some jurisdictions in New Jersey, Maryland, New York, and then also D.C.
In Massachusetts, they ended their rent control.
That's Vanessa Carter, a USC researcher who co-authored a recent report into the effects of rent regulations.
Economic theory suggests that there would be units taken off the market, folks would stop building, that it would create a market distortion. But the research on the actual impacts of rent stabilization don't show that.
Carter's research found that rent control tends not to affect new construction. The local rules she studied exempted new buildings from rent limits. Carter did find that rent regulations helped people stay in their homes.
When we look at housing stability, it's quite clear that rent stabilization does create more stability.
But that's been eclipsed in much of the discussion surrounding Proposition 10, prompting Carter to ask,
who has the power to change our policy framework? That tends to be landlords in the U.S.
A recent poll by USC and the Los Angeles Times found the vote on Proposition 10 is likely to be very close. In Los Angeles, I'm Matt Chinoco for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which goes out to Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever and wherever you are. 10 years ago today, she or he, because nobody really knows who the creator of Bitcoin actually is, released a white paper entitled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. A mere 9 pages long, including references, it launched the cryptocurrency craze, I suppose you could say. The BTC-USD exchange rate today, that's Bitcoin to the dollar, it's about $6,340 to one Bitcoin. That's down from a high late last year, as you might remember, of almost $20,000 per. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 241 today, 0.9%. NASDAQ up 144, 2%. S&P 500, 29 points higher, 1%. October, though, lousy. Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Talladay engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.